Senior Focus. Kia ora, this is Senior Focus and I'm Alex Bonham, and today on the show we've got Bruce Kendall, the Olympic gold sailing champion from the 1980s and now also on the Howick local board. He's been training sailors for many, many years, and with Sail GP on this weekend, I thought it was a great opportunity to talk a little bit about how sailing has changed and what it's like to be a sailor and what his life has been like in more recent years. So hello, Bruce.
Hello, Alex. How are you?
I am very well, thank you. It's lovely to have you on. Thank you for the time. So let's just start off. How's it going on the local board?
It's been really interesting. This is my coming to the end of my second term. I think you and I were elected at the pretty much the same time, so I think we're in the same space here.
Yeah.
And it's been really interesting to get to understand the beast that is Auckland Council. It's a massive organisation. There's a huge amount of money going through it. I think it's possibly New Zealand's biggest employer. And of course, on the Howick local board, we're just very, very low on the rung, in a sense, of what we can do and what we can influence. And my focus has really been on coastal erosion and clean water and improving our play facilities to be more inclusive for kids that are older than about 10, so that we've got skate parks and all that sort of other things. So I've helped to initiate getting a half pipe and we've got a skate park happening soon.
You've been a champion for the oceans and outdoor recreation all your life, I think. So let's to go back a little bit to your early days. What was it like learning to sail back in the 70s, wouldn't it be?
Yes, well,
sorry, Bruce.
I didn't really have much of a choice as to what sort of sport I'd get into when I was young. I was pretty much the week after I was born, actually the week before I was born, my mother rowed the family yacht, which is a 22-foot mullet boat from Browns Island back towards Buckland's Beach, because she had enough of me being inside and she wanted me out. So, and the boat had run out of wind and they didn't have a motor. So I guess Dad sort of sailed and Mum rode the new towing the mullet boat back to Buckland Beach from Otahi. And then I was born, and then I think the following week I was pretty much taken out on the boat cruising. And so eventually, of course, when I was older, about 7, the family tender got converted so that it had a sail on it. So I was able to sail around the bay when I was very young. So I've learned to sail when I was about 7, and I sailed the family tender from Station Bay in Motutapu back to Buckland's Beach in a building northeaster. So, I've been sailing a lot, and it's a fantastic sport.
Wow, just thinking of modern parents who might hesitate to let their 7-year-old just go down the end of the street, and you were out there in the ocean. It sounds like... Yeah. It sounds like Swallows and Amazons, or a children's story, the childhood that all of us would like to have.
I think my father was a risk taker and a calculated risk taker, and so my sisters and I.
Well, certainly practice makes perfect, and you must have got lots of years of experience before you even started competing.
Yes, that's right. I would have been competing, I guess, against anything that was moving in the bay. So any other sail craft or dinghy or whatever, I would have been racing against. And that, in fact, is probably the definition of the yacht race, is two boats on the water. So even today when I'm out in my trimaran, if there's a launch going past, I'm trying to race it. And my wife says, "Are you racing again?"
So you're having lots of races with another person who doesn't know they're in a race.
Even better.
The secret of success. And you went off to Europe, is that right, when you were a young man and really honed your skills with Beck?
Back in the early 80s, windsurfing became an Olympic sport. In fact, the International Olympic Committee told the International Sailing Federation, you must introduce a new medal, and that would be for windsurfing, because windsurfing numbers were really going through the roof globally. It was a massive sport back in the early 80s, and it started in the mid-70s. And so in 1982, Yachting New Zealand held the first test event to decide which sailors from New Zealand, which two sailors from New Zealand would be able to go to Los Angeles for the pre-Olympic regatta in order to prove to Yachting New Zealand and the New Zealand Olympic Committee that the New Zealand windsurfers had medal-winning potential. And by that, they mean, and it's the same rules today, that you had to finish in the top 10. And I just, prior to that, sailed from Auckland down to Tauranga and back, following my parents' yacht on my windsurfer. And those enormous hours on the water really gave me an extra gear. And so when I competed in that event in Auckland, I won most of the races, and so I got to represent New Zealand in the pre-Olympic regatta in Los Angeles along with Grant Beck. And so they paid for my air ticket to go there, and there was free accommodation there because Ralph Roberts had arranged free accommodation, because really I don't come from a wealthy family, and I really didn't have the finances to be able to pay for myself to go overseas. And in fact, I never imagined I'd ever have enough finances to be able to travel overseas. And so it was like a dream come true to go to Los Angeles. And I finished 18th, and Grant finished further back. And it really made us aware of what the level of competition was. And so I made a pact with Grant right there and then. I said, look, you know, we're a long way behind the rest of the world. The only way we're going to catch up is if we share all our information with each other. And because I realised they had the same commitment level as I. And and also, this was at a time when in New Zealand the International 470 class was very, very strong. We had the likes of Chris Dixon and David Barnes and Hamish Wilcox. And Hamish, of course, has gone on to coach Blair Tuke and Peter Burling to win all their medals in the 49er. And also coached them leading up to the last American Cup in New Zealand. And so Hamish is an absolutely astounding sailor. And he and Dave Barnes won the World Championships in the 470, I think, three times. But at that time, all the 470 crews did not cooperate with each other. And the Tornado crews, Rex Sellers, who went on to win a gold medal at the Olympic Games in Los Angeles, and Chris Timms, they wouldn't compete with or train with the other Tornado sailors. But it was a very different idea that I had, that I said to my main competitor, hey, look, let's share all our information and work together. And so the following year, Grant and I went to America again, because it was much cheaper than going to Europe. We couldn't afford that. And we travelled around America basically hitchhiking and sleeping in the rough people's houses, under trucks, telephone booths, public toilets, kitchens, all sorts of places, just to be able to compete and train. And during that period, I got good enough to be able to finish seventh in the pre-Olympic regatta in Los Angeles, and that qualified New Zealand to the New Zealand Olympic Committee to show that we were good enough to finish in a medal contention position, which is in the top 10. So then we just had a course, stay on course, and the rest is history. We went to the Olympic Games.
That's so fantastic. Though a question is bugging me. What did you do with your windsurf when you were sleeping in a public toilet?
Well, in those days, the events were quite different. Because windsurfing was so popular and the equipment was actually pretty simple, it was quite cheap. And so when we went to an event, we'd either charter the equipment or we would borrow it or we would be sponsored it. And so we just travelled around America for 6 months, going from event to event to event, using all sorts of different equipment. So I never actually owned any of the equipment that I was competing on when I was in America.
Wow! A bit like the Challenger movie. I don't know if you've seen that movie, but yeah. just doing the circuit on the smell of an oily rag. And did you win prize money at places?
In those events, no. And also, that time, there was that strange position of amateur sport and professional sport. And the rules were that you could not win prize money. If you won prize money, you became a professional. And after some time, they modified the rules and they went, well, actually, as long as if you win the prize money is held by Yachting New Zealand and they can... they can agree to what that money gets spent on. So if I wanted to buy new equipment or an air ticket or something like that, Yachting New Zealand would approve spending and they would either purchase it or I'd give a receipt. That's how I retained my amateur status. And leading up to the Olympic Games in 1984, there wasn't really any events that I was able to go and that I could earn any substantial amount of prize money. But after the 1984 Olympic Games, I ended up getting sponsored, and so I could sail full-time, because leading up to the 1984 Olympic Games, I'd literally work half the year and sail half the year. And the job that I had at the time, I was sheet metal labouring. So I was working in a factory in South Auckland, Fryrand Boats, and helping to clamp together aluminium boats and helping to prepare all the metal parts for internal heaters for fireplaces. I worked pretty hard and also working in windsurfing factories, helping to build equipment for other people. So after the 1984 Olympic Games, I was able to sail full-time and I was able to the sponsored equipment, and I was able to enter into professional competitions. And so in 1986, I ended up touring around Australia, just going from prize money event to prize money event, and then later on went to Europe doing the same thing, and I just be winning prize money around the place. And it was fantastic. It was a lot more... I was a lot more motivated to win prize money than was to just win a race without prize money. So it was a lot of fun.
I was reading an article by Jan Shearer, or where Jan Shearer was interviewed, and she said that the sport has changed so much since it was essentially amateur to being professional, and that she enjoyed it so much, and she also had to have another job, and she seemed to feel that that took the pressure off as a competitor. Still loads of pressure, but not that sort of visceral pressure of trying to get food on the table, you know, but you had to win. And her son apparently decided not to have a career in sport because he didn't want that sort of pressure. How would you feel about going into the sport today?
It's very, very different. When I was competing, we were a little bit like Bruce McLaren was in the beginning with Formula One. It was really number eight wire. It was really figuring everything out as you went. And including things like diet and heart rate and breathing and all the rest of stretching, cross training, figuring out the equipment, figuring out building a program for the year for your physical training and your competitions. It was very loose in a sense. And of course now, all of those, a lot of those questions have been figured out. And so now, at the time, of course, I didn't have a coach. We didn't even have a coach boat to be able to get a coach on the water. We couldn't afford it. The top teams, like the French teams, they had two coach boats and six sailors, leading up to the 84 Olympic Games when they were training. And I had just myself and Steve Macklesson, and we were both on boards. So it was, we were really number eight wiring. And now, of course, I've been a coach for the last 30 years, and of course, all my knowledge has been delivered straight to these young sailors. And of course, the sports science with the physical training and the heart rate monitors and the blood testing and all the science that's been thrown at it, and the testing of the equipment is now hugely expensive. I think for a one windsurfer now for the Olympic Games, I seem to remember it's about $12,000 just for one set of equipment. And because you provide your own equipment to the Olympic Games now, you have to go through a whole pile of equipment to find the fastest part. So you might have go through 10 to 15 sails, for instance, to try and find the fastest sail. And then there's the mast and the foils and the whole thing. And, of course, it all wears out over time. And you're constantly trying to find fast equipment. And that's expensive. And back in the day, of course, I'd just turn up to the event,
put borrowed it
on the table, and they'd give me my equipment, and away it'd go. So, you know, it was very, very affordable then. It really was man against man. Now it's a lot more checkbook racing. If you don't have huge funding behind you, you just can't do it. And I'm really disappointed to say that, but it's just the way that this sport has gone.
Yeah. I think, well, the Sail GP, they all have the same equipment. I think that's all being provided, which sounds like a little bit of a hark back to.
Oh, yes, it is. Having said that, they really had to do that. I mean, Russell Coutts and I shared a room at in Los Angeles leading up to the Olympic Games. I know Russell pretty well, and I know how competitive he is, but he is also very astute in understanding that for top-level competition, the most important thing, really, if you want sailors, the best sailor to win, is you have to have equal equipment, one design racing. And that's essentially what the Sail GP is. And so that helps limit the budget. So it's a finite price for a team getting in. They know how much it's going to cost them, and spending more money just isn't possible. And they're not allowed to train on the equipment too much before an event. It's all very controlled, so the equipment lasts. They've got very strict rules about getting inside each other's space, so they reduce the chances of damaging the equipment, and there's big penalties for that, for getting inside each other's space, so to make sure that the equipment gets through and doesn't get damaged. And, of course, every now and then there's a problem, like they have the storm come through in Sydney and equipment got damaged and people got hurt, and you can't account for that, but at least the on-the-water sailing, which is quite chaotic in a sense, they're managing that the best they can.
So SailGP really is about testing the sailors, whereas America's Cup is just intentionally more about developing the kit. Would that be fair? Yeah.
It's a little bit like Formula One and Formula Two motorsport. And Formula One motorsport, traditionally, they spent huge amounts of money developing the engines and all sorts of tech around that. Whereas in Formula Two, the engine is a one design engine, and they have seals on the engine, so you cannot modify the engine. The only thing that you're allowed to modify was the aerodynamics or the that's pretty much it, and the tyres. And so it was a lot more affordable, so it's a lot more man on man. So the top Formula One drivers tended to come from Formula Two.
Ah, I'm learning so much. That makes sense. Thank you. So I can tap into your teacher persona a bit more. So how does the Sail GP race work? Is it two by two, or do they all shoot off at the same time, or how does it work?
Good question. So in the America's Cup, we saw in the very, very beginning, they had some fleet racing. But really, when it came down to the elimination series, it was one boat racing against one boat, and it was an elimination ladder. And Sail GP, they've recognised that if you want to have an event with multiple different countries all competing at the same time, you have to have a fleet race. And in a sense, the entry fee to compete in the Sail GP by these teams, it's quite high. Of course, that pays for the equipment and shifting the equipment around the world, etc. And also, there's a commitment to the teams showing up at all of the events. So it's quite expensive. So that kind of limits the amount of teams that can compete. And Russell has pretty much handpicked a lot of these people right from the get-go. And so that's why we've had Team New Zealand in there, and the British and the Americans and Australians. And it's interesting, if you look on a lot of the national teams' boats, the sailors come from different countries. So we've got some New Zealanders sailing on some of the other national teams' boats.
Oh, so that sort of increases the chance of Kiwis winning, which is excellent. I think, though, the New Zealand team has got a very good chance, wouldn't you say?
Oh, yes. I mean, I know Peter and Blair very well and pretty much all the very well. I've known them for quite some time, and they're obviously excellent sailors. And I think one of the special things that these sailors is that the top sailors generally have come from an Olympic campaign background and done well in Olympic campaigns. The New Zealand sailors in particular have travelled and raced together for many years, and they're all very, very good sailors. And so they're all on the same page. They're a really, really strong team. And I don't think the other teams from the other countries have had that sort of continuity or that strong base. And particularly Peter and Blair, they've spent so many years together. They can do no wrong in a sense. You know, they're an excellent combination.
Well, I'm touching wood for you, Bruce, when you're saying.
Nothing could go wrong. My last Olympic campaign was unsuccessful. I sailed the Tornado, and Blair Tuke was my crew, my last Olympic event. And so Blair had just recently come out of sailing in the 29er, which is a youth class, and he was the crew for a young girl, and they just done really, really well. And so I asked him to sail with me, and I have to say it was a highlight of my Olympic campaign was sailing with Blair. He was such a great guy to sail with.
Oh, that's so cool. This is a quick technical question. How on earth can these foiling sailing boats go faster than the wind if they are being propelled by the wind?
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
It's amazing.
It absolutely defies belief that happened. And I've known that sailcraft can go many times faster than the wind in ice sailing. And I've known about that for years. And those craft are amazing. And like 4 knots, 5 knots of breeze, they're going like 100 kilometres. So let me put that easier to understand. And say walking speed, no, jogging speed of wind, the ice boats are able to go at 100 kilometres an hour.
It's crazy. And what happens if something goes wrong at that sort of speed?
And the reason that that can happen is because there's no friction on the ice. And so the wing shape of the sail allows it just to go faster and faster and faster.
Oh, so it's like cumulative.
It's a cumulative thing. But if you're going, like, on a bicycle, for instance, the thing that prevents you from going any faster is the wind.
Mm.
But if you're a yacht and that wind can help you to go faster, well, you just keep on going faster and faster until the thing that's slowing you down is drag. And primarily in a yacht, the thing that slows you down is the drag of the hull going through the water. And so that was one of the big things that when windsurfing came along, suddenly you've got a skimming craft. So suddenly it's got a lot less drag than a yacht where the whole thing's sitting in the water. And so a windsurfer was planing, and it was also using the centerboard to act like a hydrofoil to lift the whole board out of the water to reduce the wetted surface, to reduce drag so you can go faster. So windsurfing sort of led the charge as far as efficient sailing is concerned, and developed the rigs to be able to go faster and faster with camber and new sails to have a solid wing-shaped sail and a soft leech, so the back edge of the sail is soft like a bird's wing and the front edge is hard like a bird's wing. So windsurfing developed that, and of course that those ideas and concepts have been taken into yachting and developed and now of course the foiling has been introduced, and so instead of a centerboard giving you lift, which a centerboard's like a keel to stop you from going sideways, but if you turn it on the side, it works like a wing. And so essentially that's what these foils are doing. So they're like a wing in the water that can lift the whole thing out of the water and reduce the wetted surface. And so the new foils that they've got on these boats, the new T foils, are produce more lift or a smaller wetted surface so that the new boats can go faster.
There we go. Well, I understand it now. And to bring us back to local board and council land, I think we're going to get some foiling ferries, aren't we? Or at least a foiling craft.
Yes. So I understand the Parthenon Bay to Auckland service will be foiling very soon. The charging systems for the ferry dock at Parthenon Bay are being installed now. And with the reduced amount of wet surface on the ferry, it will improve fuel efficiencies and efficiencies in what you need to drive the boat through the water. And so they'll be able to convert to electric, which is going to be much better for the environment. And here we go. It'll be a great step. And then also the other aspect, which is something that people might not have thought too much about, is the wake behind the boat will be a lot less, and so there'll be a lot less coastal erosion. And we know in the Tamaki Estuary that we've had a lot of coastal erosion due to the increased boat traffic in the Tamaki Estuary. And in the past, the passenger ferries were the worst culprits, and that will no longer be the case around Auckland when the ferry's foiling.
That is so amazing, and we've just run out of time, but I've so enjoyed talking to you, Bruce, and to connect up the power of competition and windsurfing now to saving our environment around Auckland. It's just smashing. Thank you so much, and I hope you have the best rest of the week of the weekend.
Thanks, Alex, and you too. And may everything go well with your next election. I'm you're standing.
I am, and you too. See you, Bruce.
Thank you. Bye for now.
Bye.